Governor Rauner delivers his budget address tomorrow. It will be his fourth and, of course, one during an election year. We'll delve into the politics of delivering a budget in Springfield with WUIS's Daisy Contreras and the Daily Line's Ray Hodge. We also learn about some potential alternatives to road salt in Springfield, including beet juice. But first, in the early part of the 20th century, women who worked at the Illinois Radium Dial Company used toxic radium-laced paint. As Darlene Halm, the niece of one of the workers, explains, it was a novelty at first.
Sometimes she would take her younger siblings into the bedroom that they all shared, and they would go in there in the dark, and they would paint their fingernails and their lips and their eyebrows and then laugh because they glowed in the dark.
Darlene Halm's aunt would go on to die from radium poisoning. We hear more about her story during this special broadcast of the 21st in Springfield. Stay tuned. We'll get started after the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You may have heard the stories. In the early 1900s, women worked at the Illinois Radium Dial Company in Ottawa, Illinois. They were hired to paint the watch and clock dials with the radium-laced glow-in-the-dark paint. The paint got everywhere, in their hair, on their clothes, and in their mouths. It was a bit of a novelty, these glowing radium girls. But we now know it was so much more ominous. In fact, they were dying. We're here at the 21st this week, live at NPR Illinois as part of our visit this week to Springfield. Yesterday, we were at the Lincoln Library Museum. Tomorrow, we'll be at the state capitol for the budget address. And joining me now is NPR Illinois reporter Mary Hansen. She's been working on a series of stories about the tragic story of these radium girls and the environmental aftermath that continues in Ottawa for Illinois Issues. Mary, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Mary, maybe you can start by telling us a little bit about this radium dial company. Was it the only one in the country?
It wasn't. There were a couple of other radium clock factories that used radium-laced paint, a couple in on the East Coast in New York, Connecticut, and New Jersey. There were actually two companies in Ottawa, Illinois. The first radium dial opened in 1918, and it operated there until the mid-1930s when the kind of controversy over their workers getting sick and dying was kind of brewing. And so in the around 1934, the owner, Josh Kelly, was forced out of the – or excuse me, Joseph Kelly was forced out of the company, and he went across town in Ottawa and opened up a second clock factory, Luminous Processes, which then operated until 1978.
Wow. And was radium-laced paint, was that something that was common a century ago?
So it sort of became when these glow-in-the-dark clock faces kind of became trendy in the early 1920s, it kind of gained in popularity. So that's why they kind of started with these different clock factories around the country.
And this factory in Ottawa, Illinois, I wonder if we can get a little bit into the lives of the women who worked there. Of course, we know now that radium was toxic and poisoned. At the time, no one knew that. I imagine these were considered really good jobs?
They were. For the women that were hired, a lot of them were pretty young, you know, in their late teens and early 20s, and they were working and making money for their families, and it seemed like, you know, they're a good opportunity for them, and it seemed like it was kind of fun to start out with, you know, this glowing paint. There are stories of women, you know, painting their fingernails with it or their lips, you know, kind of after hours, or wearing their party dresses to work so that after work they would kind of have this glow about them as they were walking around town. So at first they were, you know, not told that, or they weren't told at all that this paint was actually quite toxic.
And then what happened?
So the women started getting sick around the early, you know, a couple years into the factory operating. They were having problems with their teeth or their jawbones because they were using these paint brushes with this radium-laced paint and using their mouths to kind of point the brushes to paint the clock faces. So they were ingesting this radium, and it was getting into their bones, and they were developing these just horrible cancers and other types of illnesses.
So it was like radiation sickness in a way?
Yes, it was intense radiation sickness.
And then, I imagine this was, was this something that obviously this was pretty painful and then women started dying?
Yeah, so in the first part of the series, Tara McCullough McAndrew, who wrote extensively about the about the Radium Girl, she wrote about Catherine Donahue, one of the dial painters who became sick, and she wrote about how Catherine walked with a limp and lost nearly half her body weight by the time she died. And she was eventually, Catherine was eventually fired from Radium Dial, actually, because of her illnesses.
I'm speaking with NPR Illinois reporter Mary Hansen. She's been working on a series of stories about this tragic story of the Radium Girls, and the existing environmental aftermath that continues for folks in Ottawa. We will tweet out all of those stories. So if you follow 2NST Show, you can see all of the reporting that Mary and the other folks at NPR in Illinois have been doing. She mentioned Tara McClellan McAndrew. She got in touch with Denise Halm, who's the niece of Peg Looney, who worked at the factory. And Denise is on the line with us right now. Darlene is on the line with us now. From Ottawa. And she's Ottawa, by the way, is about 80 miles southwest of Chicago where she lives. Darlene, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So, Darlene, you never met your aunt, but growing up, what did you hear about her experience working at the Radium Dial Company?
Well, actually, I grew up hearing the story. My aunt was one of 10 children. She was the second oldest and the oldest girl. And she had red hair. She was about 5'2", had freckles. And I was told I looked like her. I am a redhead, 5'2", freckles. And so I was always kind of fascinated by her story. But growing up, we would go out to the cemetery to see her grave and put flowers at the grave. And so I remember hearing about this for a very, very long time. And we lived right down the alley from the site of the original Radium Dial plant.
And
so I used to play around the building. When
I was
going to
say, yeah, when you were, what did people tell you about the factory when you were a kid? I guess no one said stay away from it, right?
No one did. And so we played around it. And actually, when I lived near it, it was the Farm Bureau building, and in the basement for years they had a meat locker that people would go and could go and get meat from, and the basement was where they had stored the radium, and obviously it was not cleaned up prior to being used as a meat locker.
So your aunt, Peg, what did your family tell you about when she started getting sick? What happened?
Well, she started there at a very young age. And it was depression. There was 10 kids. They lived in a two-bedroom house.
How old was she?
She was 17 when she started there.
Mm.
And so she started working there. And with her friends, she was friends with Marie Rossiter. So they started working there, and I think she really kind of enjoyed it. And then she began getting sick, but the company would tell the girls that the radium would not harm them. It would give their cheeks a rosy glow and that kind of thing. And so they denied any harm whatsoever. Now, when she passed away, she was 24 years old. And when she died, she actually passed out and collapsed at work. And so they took her to a company hospital, which I have not been able to determine where that was.
Mm.
So she was in the hospital for about 8 days. They would not allow her family to see her. And so what happened was when she died, the family, she died at like 2 a.m. in the morning, and they were going to take and bury her immediately. And the family said, no, she's a good Catholic girl. She will have a Catholic funeral. Well, they were going to do an autopsy. And because they were going to do the autopsy, the family insisted that their family doctor be there for the autopsy. Well, the company gave the family doctor the wrong time, and when he got there, the autopsy had already been completed, and they wrote on her death certificate that she had died from diphtheria.
Oh, my goodness. What did your family Did your family know that it was from radium? When did that come out, and what did your family say to the company at the time?
Well, they did suspect it. I mean, a lot of the women were getting sick. And after she died, my grandfather actually asked my uncle, her older brother, to speak with an attorney about a lawsuit. And he did that, and he was told there was no case. And this was prior to the lawsuit that Catherine Donahue and the other women were in, because my aunt was one of the first ones to have died.
We're speaking with Darlene Holm. She's on the line with us from Ottawa, telling us the story of her aunt. Mary Hansen's in studio with me here at NPR Illinois. Mary, this story happened dozens of times that we're hearing about. We're hearing about Darlene's family. This happened. We don't even know how many women passed away, do we?
Right. And Kate Moore wrote a book about these radium girls, and she has kind of the most recent kind of estimate. She says it could be in the thousands of women nationwide who died, but we don't know just how many in Illinois.
Darlene, now that you look back on this, I wonder, as you're thinking about this experience now, if there's anything else you'd like to share with us?
I have a lot of information, but your show isn't long enough. Actually, they did exhume my aunt's body, and her body was taken to Argonne National Lab and examined, and it was so radioactive that when they returned it in a lead coffin. So she was really contaminated. And Argonne they tested a lot of former radium dial workers from across the U.S. and did a lot of testing. I think it was funded by the Atomic Energy Commission. So they did the medical study of the workers, and they found a lot of the women, a very high percentage of women, had radium-caused cancers, and about 50% of them, by the time the study was completed, they had passed away.
Mm. Darlene, thank you so much for sharing your family story with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mary, so this company actually set up shop across town, right? Because then they were shut down. We're just hearing the story of not just Darlene's aunt, but all of these countless other women. But then the company continued until the 70s?
Yeah, so they continued to operate in Ottawa, making these glow-in-the-dark clocks and watches until about 1978, when they were actually shut down for multiple environmental and health violations. And that's around – it took another maybe 5 or 6 years before they really kind of figured out the environmental contamination.
And those problems still continue today, right, Mary? So can you tell us – the EPA did a lot of cleanup – but how many contaminated areas remain?
So just one. It's actually one of the larger areas. One contaminated site remains. It's 17 acres near the Fox River, which actually the state of Illinois owns. At one point, they had wanted to put a state park there. And that site actually used to be the city dump, which is why there's so much contamination there. So when the first company shut down Radium Dial, in 1968, they tore down that building, the original Radium Dial factory. And at that point, they didn't know that all of that, all the building debris, all that was actually radioactive. So they didn't know that at the time. So a lot of it was kind of trucked around town and used as fill and other construction sites. So that's how some of that contamination spread. And then the rest was brought to the city dump near the Fox River. So that's that final site that needs to be cleaned up.
And so now, can you tell us a little bit about some of the people in Ottawa who are spearheading this effort?
So actually, a local group, Residents Against a Polluted Environment, they started bringing attention to the radiation and the contamination left by Radium Dial back in the early 1980s. And I talked with two members of that group, Ken Ritchie and Katie Tricoli. Katie's a real estate agent now, but when they started this group over 20 years ago, she was a young mother, and she talked about how she and the other members of the group, they would show up at town hall meetings and city council meetings trying to ask questions to the mayor and other elected officials about cleaning up the contamination and boarding up some of the second plant, the luminous process, is plant building and trying to make that safe again. And she says that at that time when they were trying to bring attention to this, they kind of felt ostracized. They were looked at as, she says, the radical fringe.
And we actually have there's a little bit of audio of this that we have as well, right?
Yes.
So this is Kate Tricoli.
Mm-hmm. Problem is, we were right. It was nice to be right, but not because our community was contaminated. And we knew we had serious problems that were going to have to be addressed. And there's never any money to do these things. So, you know, it was a huge hurdle.
And we just have about a minute or so left, Mary, but I just wanted to ask you what's going on right now. What are sort of the challenges now that remain? There's folks in Ottawa who are working really hard to deal with this, but...
So Katie mentioned funding is always the biggest challenge, as it is with this project. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, it's going to cost around $70 million to clean this final site up. And the state of Illinois owns it, and it's also an EPA Superfund site, which means it qualifies for federal funding. So the state is responsible for about half that cost. So I talked with the Ottawa mayor, Bob Eschbach, and he said, you know, he's confident it's been a kind of a slow process to get it cleaned up, but he's confident that they'll finish it.
That's Mary Hansen. She's a reporter with NPR Illinois. The series that NPR Illinois has done for Illinois Issues about the Radium Girls is online. Lots more reporting here than we were able to get to. But Mary, thanks so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Stay tuned. We will be continuing our show from WUIS, NPR Illinois, in Springfield. You're listening to The 21st.
WILL programming is supported by the University of Illinois Press, publisher of scholarly and regional interest books and journals, allowing local and global readers to understand and engage with the changing world. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years of publishing.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're here at the studios of our partner station, NPR Illinois in Springfield. Tomorrow, we'll be broadcasting live from the state capitol ahead of Governor Rauner's budget address. The budget address is when the governor is supposed to lay out spending and revenue plans for state government before members of the state House and Senate, but it's a little more complicated than that, especially when we think about this governor and the past couple of years, and then add in that we've got an election year. Governor Rauner's facing a primary challenge from State Representative Jeannie Ives. There are six Democrats that are hoping to beat him in the general election this November. There's a lot to get into. I'm joined now by two reporters who are based here in Springfield to help us make sense of all of this. Daisy Contreras is a reporter with NPR Illinois. Ray Hodge is a Springfield editor of The Daily Line. Both of you, welcome to the 21st. It's nice to be here in person with you guys.
Well, thank you. Very good to finally meet you.
Yeah. Ray, let's start with you. Maybe for people who haven't heard of a budget address before, and I think all the folks in Springfield maybe have, but all of the other people listening throughout the state, maybe there are some folks who haven't heard a budget address. What do you think we're going to hear from the governor tomorrow?
So there's a couple of things that we've already kind of gotten a glimpse of in terms of a preview, and there's more today even that we'll still hear from. As of right now, Senate President John Cullerton is scheduled to give an update about some of his budget priorities. We've also heard a budget roadmap from the nonpartisan Fiscal Analysis Center, the Civic Federation. And then there's also other budget concerns and issues that have arose via reports and things like that. Most recently, we heard about a $600 million deficit. Is that right, Daisy?
That's correct.
All right, so that's the right number. And basically what that is going toward are not the back due bills for the Department of Corrections and other executive agencies and Medicaid bills, but the current ones that piled up after some of the back due bills were paid. So we're definitely going to see something about that. And then in that committee, the Office of the Budget director under Governor Rauner also said that we would be hearing about a plan to address the $9 billion mm-hmm. backlog as well.
All right. So we've got lots of problems here is basically what you've outlined, Ray, right? Because, and let's just back up and remind everybody, we had a budget impasse. So we had 2 years of not having a budget passed.
Right.
That's part of the backlog of the spills. But then that comes on top of the pension liabilities that we have as well. That's what you're kind of outlining here in terms of these numbers.
Yep, absolutely. And what you've got there is just like your water bill, right? If you owe a bit on your water bill, you're going to pay that off, but the water bills are going to keep on coming. And so what we're seeing is a small amount of shortfall here in terms of those bills that kept on coming.
And so this budget address is also different because it's an election year. And Deasy, I wanted to ask you about that, just the fact that because this is an election year, how are we going to sort of see that play out? Do you think there's going to be more pressure to actually, first of all, on all the lawmakers, right, to just even have a budget as opposed to the budget impasse we've had over the past 2 years?
Right. Yeah. As you said, this would be a unique time where, as you've mentioned, we have a governor running for re-election, and we're for the first time in the last 2 years, the state is sort of running on a budget in place, which happened, I may add, not because the governor was happy with the budget, the proposed spending plan, but because several Republicans broke ranks and joined Democrats in overriding his veto last year, which also resulted in a tax hike to fund the deficit. And it was something the governor was not supporting at all. In his State of the State address last month, Governor Rauner made the promise to deliver a balanced budget tomorrow, but many lawmakers remain skeptical on that. Many believe he will not be able to deliver as promised, just as they say he hasn't been able to deliver at all in the last few years. So, basically, as a candidate, he has to come up and convince lawmakers that he's going to have a balanced budget, and make sure that the plan can garner bipartisan support.
That's Deasy Contreras. Ray Hodges also with me as we're talking about ahead of the budget address that Governor Rauner is delivering tomorrow. And Ray, I wanted to ask you, this will be the fourth budget address that Governor Rauner will be delivering. The first two or three, we heard a lot about Governor Rauner's turnaround agenda,
right,
which in part he talked about having lower taxes for individuals and corporations. Obviously, last year, the General Assembly raised taxes as part of the override of governor's veto. What are we thinking in terms of what we're going to hear with a tax increase?
That is definitely something that's in the water right now. Just like you were saying, Deasy was saying, this is a very much an election year. And this is we're all kind of expecting an election year budget, especially with the taxes, what you're talking about here. We're looking at a rollback of 3%, right? That's one of the things that's sort of anticipated in terms of getting the sort of unpopular tax hike back down. We don't know how far that'll get, obviously. I mean, you've got a state that's still very much trying to play catch up. And so who knows how far a repeal of that kind of tax will go. But that is expected to be one of his big sticking points there. And it's a point that he's been kind of attacked on, not only from the Republicans that broke ranks, but some of the even further more fiscally conservative Republicans that are out there right now. It's been a big campaign point.
You mentioned the nonpartisan Civic Federation. When we're talking about what we're looking at, other organizations talking about how the state can fix its fiscal mess, what are they saying in terms of revenue for the state apart from taxes?
Well, I tell you, the Civic Federation's budget roadmap, and you've probably looked at this just as much as I have, probably more so, Deasy. But the roadmap that I'm seeing so far, if I could sum it up in one sentence, it would be, we're not out of the woods yet. So they're kind of restrained on the idea of repealing taxes from what I've read. Is that kind of your read on it, Deasy?
Along that route, and making sure that the state has a rainy day fund, making sure that we have a pension plan in mind. Some sort of the same topics that we've been hearing over the last couple of years.
Yeah, it's really restrained on, its recommendations in terms of how much we should pull back on tax measures, because obviously, there's that mounting debt. It's really not going anywhere, and the bills are going to keep on coming.
And so we got a little bit of idea of what to expect last week, right, Deasy? We had the governor's budget chief, Hans Zygmunt, gave a briefing in front of a Senate committee. What did we learn from him, Daisy, about what maybe his office has in mind? I think he was trying to be really careful, right,
yes,
to not get out in front of the governor. I think those were his exact words at one point. But what did we learn from him?
Well, we do know that we have a $9 billion shortfall, which, as Zygmunt said, that the governor is going to address definitely tomorrow in his budget address. Some of this is the $8.4 billion in unpaid bills that have been accumulating over the last few years. And while these bills go unpaid, they continue to accumulate interest. And the governor in the last few months, weeks, he's alluded to doing some spending cuts. We don't know where those cuts will be. We don't know what kind of, you know, specifics. Like you said, Zygmunt was very careful to not give too many details. And so, the plan is to address how are we going to look at the backlog of bills.
Yeah. And then, so a part of this, $1.1 billion, there was a term that I heard, and I want to introduce this with you guys right now. Some people at the meeting were confused by this this phrase that came up. It was called unappropriated liabilities. And I have a little bit of the exchange. I thought we should play it for everybody here. Here's Democratic State Senator Andy Menar asking Hans Zygmunt what that means. And here's what Zygmunt said in response.
I think we've invented a new term, unappropriated liabilities. So can you help us in the front of the budget book?
Yeah.
There's a definition of terms. So help us understand what the book on Wednesday of next week is going to say when a definition is offered for unappropriated liability.
I don't know that it will be a term that's defined in the book, but I'll give you my definition nonetheless. It is a liability that was incurred by the state in spite of the fact that there was no appropriation authority to do the spending.
Okay, that's an exchange last week at a Senate committee meeting here in Springfield. Ray, can I first ask you, have you ever heard this phrase before, unappropriated liabilities?
You know,
I'm just trying to understand what it means.
So the first time I saw it pop up was in a Bloomberg article. Basically, what is being danced around here is the fact that the clip that we just heard is Hans Zygmunt, the budget chief for Rahner. Basically, he's asking for $600 million in supplemental, right? And what he's saying is about 75% of that is going to go towards Medicaid payments and the Department of Corrections to keep their lights on, their trash taken out, and their food continue to deliver. Now, the big bone of contention in that meeting that centered around this new term of unappropriated liabilities, it became a sticking point with Zygmunt saying, hey, you know, we warned you guys that this wasn't enough in the Department of Corrections budget, that we were going to still have day-to-day mundane, keep the lights on kind of needs, with the committee, on the other hand, saying, we don't know what you're talking about with that. So the unappropriated liabilities are, you know, our last year's budget, here is your budget, pay down your back bills, pay down your vendors. But the unappropriated portion is supposedly the bills that kept on coming the next day.
And so, Daisy, does that mean that the Rahner administration spent $1.1 billion that lawmakers didn't give them permission to spend?
Yeah, basically that's what Zygmunt was alluding to, that, yes, they didn't have the money that they needed to pay bills that
had already.
So
did they not have the money that they needed, or was it just not appropriated?
It wasn't appropriated, but what it's important to remember, though, is to be fair Zygmunt and to the Republicans, really, who were also speaking out in that meeting, they were statutorily mandated to make some of these Medicaid payments, and they couldn't just say, well, you know,
We're not paying it. Right.
So they did have a mandate to pay it. And then on top of that, you know, I mean, whether the money's there or not, someone's going to find a way to make sure that prisons have their lights on, one would hope. And so this seems like a, you know, budget talks, budget meeting, pre-budget issue that never really got worked out properly, and that now we're seeing a supplemental sort of problem.
And so do you all think this will be a problem going forward, this $1.1 billion, or is this more just a partisan kind of, not, I don't want to say semantic fight, but
Piper's got to be paid. The Piper has got to be paid. One way or another, there's statutory mandates for Medicaid payments. There is, you know, statutory mandates to make sure that we're taking care of Department of Corrections and things like that. How much of that spending will be accounted for, documented, and found to be appropriately done? That's the real question. The question is not necessarily whether it'll get paid or whether it'll have to be appropriated for, but how that process will play out and whether it will be the bone that they go to war over.
Right. And if I may add, you know, after that exchange we heard just moments ago, Zygmunt told Senator Menard there will be a detailed plan to address these, what he called 2017
tomorrow. So issues. Tomorrow we will hear this detailed plan. That's Daisy Contreras with NPR Illinois. Ray Hodge, who's a Springfield editor of the Daily Line, is with me. And Daisy, just to get back to the fact that, so we just kind of saw this Senator Menard, Democrat, kind of going off, facing off against this Republican, well, at least working for Republican Governor Rauner. How much are we going? I mean, this partisan fight has been what has stymied the state for the past 2 years. Now that it's an election year, for both of you, if you can weigh in here, I mean, now there really is an incentive. This really cannot be a year where they don't pass a budget, can there?
No, I mean, it's not just the budget that the governor needs. It's he has to make sure it's a balanced one. And in the past, the governor has presented budget proposals and made some hefty demands. Lawmakers, especially Democrats, haven't agreed with those demands. And so those proposals weren't even balanced to begin with. And so I guess, yeah, in order for him to, I guess, regain some sort of lost trust, he needs to avoid another impasse under his name.
And the same, I would say, is you know, a lot of these lawmakers who, you know, have decided that they're going to retire after being on the brunt end of the budget deal, after going against the leader of their ranks, are now going to be in a situation where if you're retiring, you got to get a budget, you got to bring it home. You really don't have politically very much to lose. Mm-hmm. So you might as well do what's good for your people. You might as well vote your conscience and bring home whatever bacon you can get. Whether that leads you to loggerheads with the governor again, who knows? But
well, if you're not running again, there's not a consequence either, right? Because then you don't necessarily have a worry about Governor Rauner funding an opponent for you, as we saw those things sort of play out in the previous election cycles, right?
Exactly.
So we just have a couple minutes left. There was just one other political headline that I wanted to touch on briefly that was big news this morning. The Chicago Tribune reporting the Me Too movement hitting Speaker Madigan's office. Ray, what's the news here?
So from what we can understand, back in November, a campaign worker formally wrote a letter to Speaker Madigan upon the day that she was going to leave his political operation in the 13th Ward. And it detailed a series of events that went on prior to that. The events basically were she was receiving inappropriate text messages.
So this is Alana Hampton,
correct?
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Alana was receiving a string of inappropriate texts from a supervisor at that time, Kevin Quinn, who has since been fired. She brought it to the operation. She says in the Chicago Tribune article that she received workplace retaliation. She went to the Equal Employment Office, filed a complaint there. And then, if I'm not mistaken, she went to Alderman Quinn, who is the brother
of
Kevin
Quinn.
Mm-hmm. And Alderman Quinn said something to the effect of, he's not going to bother you again, and then offered her a much coveted spot as a precinct captain. She said, no, that means I'm going to have to keep on working with Kevin, not something I really want to do. She decided to leave and part ways from there. November, she sent the letter. We hear nothing about it until Sunday night. I think the Tribune reporter interviewed her. And then first thing in the morning before the Trib story came out, we got a press release in the inbox from the speaker's spokesperson detailing that Quinn had been fired and that that the speaker had called Alana a courageous woman.
So it's sort of the latest in Springfield. Ray, is this kind of the talk of the Capitol today?
Not only is it the talk of the Capitol, but me and Daisy know right now what we're missing is a press conference where Ms. Hampton should be at the Capitol at this moment, if I'm not mistaken. So we're very likely going to see more updates here in the next few hours if they're not already hitting the waves now.
Right. And we're actually going to be talking about that later in the week with former Daily Herald reporter Carrie Lester, who's been writing about this issue as well. I want to thank Ray Hodge. She's a Springfield editor of the Daily Line. You can sign up for that to get more information about the ins and outs of Springfield. Daisy Contreras with NPR Illinois. Ladies, thank you for being with me. Thanks
thank
for giving
so
us a preview of the budget here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
St- stay tuned to the 21st. We're continuing our special coverage from Springfield. Up next, I don't know if you've been slipping on the ice out there. We have been, as I've been walking around downtown. We're actually going to be speaking with the director of Public Works Springfield about what they have been doing, alternatives to salt to kind of prevent icing on the road. So stay tuned to the 21st. We'll start that conversation just after this short break. Listening to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You've been hearing it all winter. Be careful out there. It's icy. Roads and sidewalks are treacherous. The only way to combat it was with salt. It does the job, but it's a pain to lug around. It leaves a mess on your car, your coat. Could be harmful to pets and kids, nearby bodies of water. Here in Springfield, the director of Public Works, Mark Mahoney, has been looking into different alternatives. He's here with us to talk about this now at the studios of NPR Illinois. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the 21st.
Good morning.
So maybe we should talk about, there's lots of alternatives, but why is salt always sort of ending up being the predominant method that everybody uses for ice? Well, is it just because it's the best thing?
It really, right now, it's cost effective. It's really, for decades, really, it's been the primary source of how we clear our roads. We use that material with plowing, in combination of plowing and applying the rock salt, as many Midwestern cities do. It's effective. It clears the roads quickly. We also can acquire it relatively cheaply compared to a lot of the other products are out there. And we try to minimize the application of salt, and really we are looking at alternatives, but at the same time we're trying to dial back on how much salt we can use and still be effective, which a lot of communities are doing right now. And one of the ways we do that is through training, is through our equipment. We have more modern equipment. We have what we call V-Box spreaders. Kind of reduces how much salt is applied.
So is that what's coming down out of the truck then?
Exactly.
So essentially that's, how do you figure out what the minimum amount of salt is that you can use? Is this just a trial and error?
There's industry standards on that. Based on the temperatures, there are a lot of variables in that. And we actually, what we've been applying, shooting for is really in that 250 to about 400 pounds per mile range. So we've reduced that down. We've as high as several hundred and plus at times. So we've basically, through training, through our technology, where we've actually calibrate the spreader so that we can only apply so much when you're spreading the salt. So and it's helped tremendously. Over the last few years, we've really reduced that salt usage on the roads. What we don't like is when you see a lot of after the storm or after the snow has been cleared, and you see a lot of salt on the side of the road.
Mm-hmm.
We had a resident actually said thank you for the Public Works for the margarita impact or effect on the road. So we don't want that. We want the salt to go away after the event.
And how has this winter been for the Department of Public Works? I mean, has this been a tough one? Has there been a lot of salt compared to the past couple of years? It seems like that answer would be yes, right?
Well, we've been very fortunate the last several years, and I don't want to jinx it because there's a lot of winter left, but we've been very fortunate this year and actually the last most of the last few years. The last time we really had a severe, I would say, where we'd basically regular application of salt and going out pretty much every week and doing some kind of winter weather treatment on the roads was probably 2014. We do some proactive approach where we brine the bridge decks. That's where we have a wetted salt. We'll go out there. We'll put that down a lot of those areas just because of with wetter weather, they get slick from time to time, and that's sort of a proactive approach. And we've started doing that on a regular basis. But as far as full operation, 2014 is really where we've had several inches of snow and we had to go dig out and remove it, and it goes on for a couple days. It's been a few years since that's happened.
And now at one point you all were looking at beet juice as a possibility, as an alternative. How did that work out?
Several years ago we did experiment with some beet juice. It was a challenge. It didn't work out real well. A lot of it has to do with the equipment.
Does it also just stain it?
Well, there's also the issues. You hear some people repeat there's an odor to it. and there's a lot of concern with using it. It's just not easy to work with. So there's a lot of products out there. You hear
pickle
people talk
juice.
About pickle juice. There's a cheese liquid. You know, wherever you are, depending on part of the country, there's even a potato juice that's usually mixed with a salt.
Cheese liquid? Is this used in Wisconsin?
They usually mix that
with
salt
like a
as a liquid.
Okay.
Exactly. Use that byproduct. They mix it with the salt, and it really it works, and it helps, and actually you can use it at colder temperatures. But again, a lot of it depends on if it's accessible or affordable, and a lot of that has to do with the location of the country. A lot of that's used in Wisconsin, where you have a lot of cheese production, so it'd be costly to go out and get that in probably any volume that would be effective, and the equipment.
So what you all have found in Springfield is that what actually just works better is just being as efficient as possible in terms of the amount of salt that you're putting down.
Exactly. We're trying to look at best practices. We work very closely with the American Public Works Association. Believe it or not, there's actually a Stowe conference every year where people from all over the country get
together.
And
they discuss salt.
Exactly. And operations and equipment and the most innovative approaches. A lot of it comes down to our staff. We have some very good people, our engineering department, as well as our operations guys, and our guys out there, truck drivers, laborers, operators doing the work. They've dealt with this a lot. They have a lot of experience. So we're always looking at new and innovative approaches of how we can apply the salt, the timing, addressing how the weather's coming in.
And
a lot of variables.
And let's hope that maybe we won't need it as much for the rest of this winter. I want to thank Mark Mahoney, the Director of Public Works for Springfield, for joining me. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.
We're continuing our series of interviews with candidates for Illinois Attorney General. The current Attorney General, Lisa Madigan, is not running for re-election. There are 8 Democrats and 2 Republicans who were hoping to replace her. The primary is on March 20th. Here's how we did all of these interviews. We made it like a job interview, so we tried to ask each candidate almost the same questions, and we recorded all of the interviews in advance. Today, we're hearing from State Senator Kwame Raoul. He represents Illinois' 13th Senate District, which stretches from Chicago's near north side south to the Indiana border along the lake. He's held that seat since 2004. That seat was previously held by President Barack Obama. He's also a former prosecutor for Cook County. Senator Raoul, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you've been in Springfield, I mentioned, as a state senator for some time. Why attorney general now?
I think it's a continuity of the work that I've been doing over the course of the last 13 years as a state senator and policymaker, as well as the last 25 years almost practicing law. So I've had the benefit of practicing law in a wide variety of areas and enacting public policy as well in a wide variety of areas that speak to the office of the Attorney General's office.
Senator Raoul, we've seen Lisa Madigan join other attorneys general in suing the Trump administration. Certainly, we've heard quite a few statements from you about the Trump administration just even within the past month or so. I wanted to ask you if you think part of the role of attorney general is to take on the federal government, in this case, the Trump administration.
Well, generally, it's if you have an administration such as this administration that's really undermining bringing services to people, whether it's access to health care, making sure that we provide for law enforcement reform, making sure that potential victims of sexual assault on campuses are protected. Yes, I think it's part of the role of attorney generals, both individually as well as collectively, to make sure that we protect the citizens of our state.
What do you see as the main role of the attorney general?
The beautiful thing about the attorney general's office is its role is broad and it's multifaceted. One, you're basically the managing partner of the law firm that represents the state of Illinois. Two, you're a policy advocate. So, you know, I don't look at myself as leaving the legislature because the Attorney General's office is very active advocating for policy changes that are good, as well as trying to block policy changes that are bad. Third, the Attorney General has a bully pulpit to advocate for issues and to attempt to protect consumers as well as victims of crime. Through both its advocacy as well as delivery of resources, particularly to victims.
Senator Rowell, you mentioned good and bad policy change in Springfield. We've certainly seen dysfunction in Springfield, particularly in the past few years, that's unparalleled. And I'm pointing, of course, to not having a budget for the past 2 years. I imagine there may be voters out there who are jaded by how terrible that environment has been for the state and wonder why they should trust someone who's been a part of that for more than a decade to be attorney general.
Well, because for more than a decade, I have personally have been doing, and I've been doing in a manner that is quite, it's bipartisan. You know, my first day in Springfield, my predecessor, Barack Obama, was there, and he pulled me into his office, and he suggested to me it was valuable for me to build relationships across regional boundaries and with people on the other side of the aisle. And I've prided myself on working in a bipartisan manner to bring about criminal justice reform, consumer protection, voting rights protection here in the state, as well as law enforcement reform. These are all things that I've done in bipartisan manner. Even the abolition of the death penalty, which I was a sponsor of, was done in a bipartisan manner.
And you mentioned the criminal justice system. Obviously, that's something that's been an important part of your tenure as a state senator. If elected attorney general, what are some actionable steps you would take in this area that you can't already do right now as a state senator?
Well, I think it's not a matter of whether or not I can do it right now, but the attorney general, as I mentioned before, has a bigger bully pulpit than an individual state senator. People listen when an attorney general speaks. I think Lisa Madigan has been a strong voice for consumer protection and for protecting victims of crime, however, has not been as vocal about criminal justice reform. I would certainly use that voice the same way that I've been using it at the legislative level, but I think it would be more influential as Attorney General. The other thing is to look at victims' resources and to have a victim-centered approach to criminal justice reform. Too often, we look at it as something, victim advocacy as something that's inconsistent with criminal justice reform, and it's not. To the extent that we can realize that there are communities that have been traumatized by violence and underinvestment that lead to people who have once been victimized, evolving into potential perpetrators, and we can interrupt that, we promote public safety in the process.
So you mentioned criminal justice reform. Are there other important priorities you would focus on if elected attorney general?
Yes, absolutely. I think one of the experiences we've had under the Rauner administration is that we've had a Department of Labor that has largely ignored valid claims of wage theft, misclassification of employees, failure to pay minimum wage and prevailing wage and things of that nature. And, you know, I've already acted to try to introduce legislation to allow the Attorney General office to directly confront these rogue employers and not have to wait for the Department of Labor to move through the investigative process if there's evidence of an egregious violator of protection of workers' rights. I think the workers' rights efforts in the Attorney General's office can be a lot more aggressive. Again, this notion of victims' resources, I've been asking the question for some time, to what extent have victims' resources gone to the most victimized communities? That would be a very high priority for me, because not only does the Attorney General have a direct ability to direct resources, but they also sit as a member of the board of the Illinois Criminal Justice Information Authority, which oversees some of the violence prevention resources that are distributed to communities.
Senator, we just have about a minute left, but I want to just ask you one last question. There's obviously a very crowded field of candidates, 8 Democrats running. There are also 2 Republicans. Why should voters choose you?
Well, simply this. I think there are some well-qualified opponents in this race, and I respect all of them. However, many of them are talking about what they promised to do in the future. What I've been talking about is what I have been doing through the course of my last 13 years of public service. I think the best predictor of what I will do as Attorney General is what I have been doing in my advocacy for voting rights protection, my advocacy for consumer protection, the sponsorship of a bill that created the public access counselor in the Attorney General's office, my sponsorship of legislation that allowed us to embrace the Affordable Care Act here in Illinois, I've been doing. And so the proof is in the pudding. You don't have to look at my promises. You can look at my deeds.
Kwame Raoul is a state senator representing Illinois' 13th Senate District, as he mentioned. It was a seat previously held by a gentleman called Barack Obama. He's also a former prosecutor for Cook County. He's one of eight Democrats who are hoping to become our state's next attorney general. Senator Kwame Raoul, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. And if you have Alexa and NPR One, you can always play a say or just say, Alexa, ask NPR One to play The 21st. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Grace Stetson is our intern, along with Fatima Farha. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Moore. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to all the folks at WUIS for helping us out with today's production. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.